This is Edwin Atkins, production manager of Highlander, the New York shoot, 1986. And it's a pleasure to be with The Blood of Kings.
Welcome, Highlander fans, to episode 129 of Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we cover everything from the Highlander universe, including movies, TV series, guest interviews, novels, audiobooks, comics, special events, and a very special interview today. With me, I have Edwin Itzy Atkins, the 1986 Highlander New York production manager. Welcome, sir. How are you today?
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's very, very awesome to have you here. I've been looking forward to talking to you. We have got a lot of Highlander fans, first of all, in our Blood of Kings group on Facebook, also our listeners around the world. And there's always been a fascination, of course, with the original Highlander. Both my fiance and I are huge fans of it. We got together because of it. And a lot of the cool things about Highlander is its locations. And you had the honor to work on the original Highlander. And I want to thank you again for coming on. And we're going to talk about Highlander in a minute, but I want to get a little background here of you. You've worked on a lot of productions, and we'll touch on a few of those later.
But about 35 features.
That's a lot. That is a lot. That's a huge accomplishment. I wanted to ask you, first of all, tell us how you first got interested in movies. Did it start as you were a child?
Yes, but I mean, I did theatrical production for 10 years. I graduated college in theater and then did the Bicentennial Outdoor Drama thing in Maryland and Dinner Theater in Summerstock. And then a movie came to where I was living in Southern Maryland, needing square rigger vessels for the Voyage of the Mayflower with Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, wow.
And I provided that plus all the extras and the locations. And at the end of that shoot, I was asked to go to New York and continue with that company doing location work.
So give us a little more background on how you broke into the movie industry. Was there family involved? Did someone...
No. It was strictly the fact that they needed me and they came to Maryland. And I provided them with everything they needed at a great price and got along with them. And then they said, you know, how would you like to transfer from theater to film? And do several pictures in New York, which was, you know, that was kind of challenging to go to Manhattan, start doing locations, getting in buildings. And the next picture I did was Playing for Time with Vanessa Williams, written by Arthur Miller about Auschwitz and the concentration camps. So that was a pretty powerful and inspiring movie to be my second one.
Wow, that's really cool. Was there any movies you remember seeing when you were younger or during college that also inspired you to see how these movies were made? And you know, was there certain locations and certain films that also inspired that thought?
Well, I think the first movie I remember my father took me to was High Noon. But the one that influenced me when I saw on my own was If. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of that movie, but it was a
What was it called again?
Movie. If, I-F.
Ah.
And a very dark movie. Sure. I mean, I enjoyed all the great movies, especially New York movies. But after theater, I went into what I call live action horror theater. Theater of the Observed, and taking a theatrical production, and instead of having fixed sets, I mean movable sets with a fixed audience, I reversed it and had a movable audience going through fixed sets, which happened to be all theater of the horror, and it turned into a into a haunted house, which was more than a haunted house. It was really theater. And that spawned 10 years of doing that. And that was called Blood Manor.
And this was one of the first of its kind, these, I guess, interactive type of haunted houses in America, right? Right.
Yeah, live action theater of the macabre. And now, before 72, when I did that with college students in an old convent, which had tons of little rooms where the nuns all lived and a chapel, and it was just perfect. There was only amusement park haunted house like Disney, or tractor trailers that came to state fairs with grapes and forced air and that kind of stuff. Nobody had actually used actors. I'm basically considered the father of the modern haunted house.
That is really cool to get the background on that on there. I think I have online here my co-host, Lee. Are you able to check in here, Lee?
Yes, sir, I am. I apologize, everybody.
Hey, Lee.
Like our guest, I am in the film industry, and auditions are kind of going crazy today. My apologies.
Well, Lee, I'd like
to talk to you, Lee.
I'd like to introduce you to Edwin Itzy Atkins, our Highlander 1986 New York production manager. And Lee, we've been talking to Itzy about some of his earlier stuff and what's inspired him and doing probably one of the first organized, fully functional haunted houses. And Itzy, you had a nickname that was given to you by the Washington Post, right?
Yeah, the Prince of Fright.
I'm jealous of that one. I got to tell you.
Lee, did you have a specific question for earlier stuff in Itzy's career?
I just wanted to talk about Rooftops because I loved that movie when I was a kid. I watch it now and, I can see why I loved it then, but Jason Gedrick doing capoeira and trying to act like a tough guy, that movie was great. But I just got to say, I'm really excited to have you on because in our industry, the production manager does not get enough love. And a lot of times that's the difference between a good set and a bad set.
Well, Rooftops was a monumental importance in my life because Robert Wise directed it. And if you know anything about Robert Wise, West Side Story, Sound of Music, he was trying to make a modern version of West Side Story called Rooftops. And he was in his 60s or 70s. And we're filming on the Lower East Side, horrible building rooftops for most of that, a lot of it at night. And he was a real trooper. And he actually, after that movie, got me to Hollywood. He thought I was really one of the best production people he had worked with.
Robert Wise is a legendary director. That must have been an honor to work for him. I mean, obviously, Sound of
Music, really was.
Star Trek, many other credits that he has. What was he like as a person?
Right. Oh, he was a gentleman, a great old man, and really, really knew filmmaking. You know, he was an apprentice editor on Citizen Kane. So when you're sitting there on the set in your chair talking film, and you're talking to somebody who goes back to Citizen Kane, you really are getting an education. And he was a great editor because he would say, look, we don't need a second take because I'm not going to use that portion of that take. I mean, he was actually editing in his head as we were shooting.
Wow.
So it was unbelievable.
I love working with directors like that.
Yeah,
I wanted to ask you, I learned something watching a seminar that you did, a video teaching in front of some UGA students. Learned that you gave Denzel Washington his first paid gig. Can you give us some behind info on that? That's fascinating.
Well, he was a student, I think, sophomore at Fordham University and wasn't doing so great. Wasn't even a theater major. And I was doing an outdoor drama called Wings of the Morning about the founding of Maryland that I mentioned. And we needed this narrator, this black slave kind of narrator. And we went up to New York to Fordham and tried to get most of the cast. And he auditioned. And I said, boy, that guy is incredible. We've got to have him. So we talked him into coming down to the Wilds of Maryland for not very much money.
About what year was this?
1976, I guess. Mm-hmm. 76, the bicentennial year. Yeah. Yeah. And he was great. And then after that, some agents from California came down there and talked to him. And I think his next thing was the Soldier Blue or whatever, the Civil War movie. But yeah, we had a good time. And I guess maybe I was good at looking at talent and seeing who really had talent. But, you know, you don't really know what a good actor is until you've been around incredible actors. For example, Vanessa Redgrave on Playing for Time. She's bald, getting ready to go to the gas chamber. She's crying, and we call lunch. And we sit down at lunch. Arthur Miller's there, Vanessa Redgrave, the director's there. Okay, back from lunch, she's on the set. The tears are coming again, and exactly, you know, just going from one extreme to another. That was when I really saw what an incredible actress could do.
Wow.
That's
really cool, especially when you get to see an actor like that just get better at the craft after year goes by. That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. But one of my interesting was that I did a movie called Side by Side in New York about three old fashion fabric people who wanted to couldn't do zippers because of their condition. So they were going to do Velcro jeans, Velcro everything, and make a lot of money. And those three guys was Sid Caesar, Danny Thomas, and Milton Berle.
Oh my gosh, legends.
And to work with those three together in one movie was unbelievable.
That is fascinating. Wow. They must have been a hoot hanging around with.
Yeah, I think it's the last thing they ever did, but just to be around them, again, war stories from the film world were just incredible.
Wow. Before we got you on recording, I touched a little bit about stuff you worked on previously and after Highlander. Before we get into Highlander, I'd like to touch on a few of those. You've worked on Clear and Present Danger, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins, one of my favorite action films, Avenging Force, The Big Easy. I want to ask you on, you know, a lot of these obviously take a lot of different attention. What was some of your experience working on some of these, and what were some of your favorites?
Well, Rooftops was very, very challenging to be on the roofs of Lower East Side for all those nights. The Big Easy was fun. New Orleans was fun with the music. And then the Clear and Present was a long movie. I was over a year on that movie, and doing that that assassination scene, which was with Victor Armstrong, Andy Armstrong's brother. So I worked twice with the Armstrongs, and that was
famous stuntman.
Yeah, they're great, and both of them were great. And I never thought when I did Highlander I'd be working with Vic, but to go into Highlander, that was one of the accomplishments of somebody like Andy Armstrong coming to Manhattan with all these ideas of a stunt. He can only do what the city's going to let him do. So he has to sit with the location and the production manager and say, okay, guys, let's design this stunt with reality. What are we going to be able to pull off with city permits and everything else? So I became, you know, very influential in the design of that stunt because we had to pull it off. And we actually had a lot more than they used. I mean, I had a store that we could have drove a car through one plate glass window, through the clothing, and then out another window. But we never shot that. But of course, the Silver Cup roof was monumental. And New York lit. You know, we had to keep all the east side of New York lit for those days that they were on Silver Cup looking back at the city. And, you know, we bought the lights on the bridge and the buildings and all of the ones that we could buy off. But all the apartment units between 34th Street and 57th Street would be dark by 10 o'clock, you know.
That must have been quite a challenge.
Yeah, it was. I actually put out a brochure about 10,000 12-inch film strips with the perf tops, and in the middle is the picture of New York and the bridge lit and all the buildings lit, and basically said, if you have an apartment that faces the East River on these dates, you can be in Highlander. You can be in the movie. All you have to do is keep your lights on in your windows that look out over the river, and you'll be in the movie. So, but it took a PA crew of about 30 to canvas with a grid system every single building and make contact with every single supervisor and put these flyers in the lobby and get that word out. But it was pretty good. You'll notice in a lot of those scenes, you know, it's not as much as I would like, but you can see the city.
How now, regarding Highlander here, because we're talking about it now, you were describing some of the details of your job description on Highlander. Can you give us some other ideas that our listeners may not know? Because Lee, you just mentioned a little while ago that production managers and assistants, they don't get the love that they deserve for all the hard work they do, right, Lee?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's the stunt guys and the actors and the directors, they kind of get all the credit, but a good film set, well, you know, one that you want to come back to, really does rely on.
I don't know what credit from who you're talking about, but you don't shoot in Manhattan unless you've got a good rapport with a New York production manager, producer. And we had John Stark as the producer, and myself as production manager, and David Stark, his brother, as the second unit production manager. So we, the three of us, had done so many movies in New York, you know, and John especially, that that made it easy for Highlander to come in. They had already filmed 53 days when they came to New York, but there was a lot more work than just the shooting. There was a lot of stuff that needed to be done so that they could match New York before they started shooting in UK. So we had to send like police uniforms, police patches, any kind of photographs of any New York thing that we were going to do here and was going to work together. For example, also the translights, you know, Alan White came over and we shot all these buildings, which you see in his office, in the office and all over, you know, the studio there looks like New York, but those are translights. And we had to shoot those weeks and weeks before they started. So there was a long interaction between us. But
it seems that having a relationship with a lot of people you've already worked with definitely made the transition for the Highlander crew to come in and just start.
Right.
What were some of the biggest challenges working in New York, shooting with Highlander?
Well, we started July 8th of 85. That was our first day in New York. And that's when we were doing the band show and Central Park, hot dog vendor, you know, exterior of McLeod's house and some street work. And, you know, Christopher didn't speak much English, and that was kind of a problem. I mean, the lead actor shows up and knows his lines, but you can't chit-chat with him. I hired a first AD, François Moulin, who is a good French-speaking first AD, and that helped a lot in the communications with Christopher.
Oddly enough, I'm heading to Miami at the end of the month. I'm working as a Spanish and French translator on a Moroccan production. But yeah, the language barrier can be interesting.
And the other thing, Russell McKay loves water and night work. I mean, everything's got water. I mean, every shot he wanted to have water, you know, and rain towers. And, you know, not just where the camera's pointing, but you need rain to the left and to the right in case this thing's move. And you've got to match it. So, and we actually had a water shortage in New York during that time, and they prohibited New York water being used for shooting. So we had to bring it in from New Jersey. Wow. But yeah, I mean, it was a lot of night work, a lot of work with water, And I guess one of the biggest disappointments were I worked very hard to get the National Hockey League and the hockey team in New York and the Madison Square Garden people all to agree that we could do the opening scene with a hockey game. And then about a week before, the hockey league president says, no, we're not going to let you do it because you're going to make hockey look violent. Well, everybody laughed about it except me, because now I had to come up with a whole new location and opening sequence. And at the very last minute, we went to the World Wrestling Federation and got them. But it was not as good as it would have been with the hockey sticks.
There's a lot of wrestling fans that are grateful that you did.
Oh, yeah. I could see those hockey sticks hitting each other and recutting to the soy play in Scotland and back. And then we had a very new camera that we were using for the first time. It's a camera on a bungee cord that is stretched all the way across Madison Square Garden in about five different directions. So the operator is pulling this camera back and forth all around. I mean, it was before drones or anything like that. So that was a big setup.
That was huge. That was the first of its kind. And then the NFL, the NFL incorporated that. And now you see all of their main primetime games, they use a camera that moves around in a similar way.
Yeah, well, that was Garrett Brown, you know, guy who started the Steadicam. He was there doing that. And of course, the Swordmaster, I think his name was Bob.
Bob Anderson.
Yeah, you couldn't touch a sword without him blessing it and everything. and of course, they were very, very strict about when those swords came out, you touched them. My stunt guy was really good, but unfortunately, he died a year later in a stunt accident. But Vic Magnotto did a great job with the production. And we did a lot of stuff that they didn't use in the movie, you know. We did a whole sequence at the zoo.
Really? Can you describe that scene a little bit?
Yeah, well, let me see. I'll show you some of the things we did. Like, I'm looking at the script. You know, the construction site fight, well, we did parts of it, not the whole thing. But we did PJ Clark's, which was the bar, exterior bar, where he meets Brenda. And then she walks outside, and of course it's raining and it's night. We did that whole bar scene. We did exterior of the antique store stuff. Let me show you a few things. Yeah, McCloud in Central Park, you know, that was two pages of material on the Bow Bridge, you know, with Castigar. So that was about. And then in the zoo, they changed the ending a lot. I guess they get the point across. But
was that going to be the end fight scene in the zoo before they moved it to another location?
No, this was the Brenda, you know, telling him she's not gonna be his wife or whatever.
Gotcha.
But. Yeah, it's like scene 131, exterior Bronx Zoo. Brenda and McCloud are touring the zoo. 132, the giraffe cage, you know. But she's saying it's all laid out, forensic, in 3 years, a luxury Columbia. So a lot of that stuff, and then they're in the lone wolf cage, and then they're in the birds, and then they're in, they're all around the zoo. The wildlife starts to act strangely. Tigers claw their cages. Monkeys go crazy. Hyenas attack one another. The bears try to climb out of the pit. That's when they realize that McCloud is, you know, there at the end. And so that was like three pages. And then Kurgan in the children's enclosure, surrounded by kids, petting sweet, furry little things. He peers through the trees. At the penguin pool, Brenda says, you know, what's weird, most people are afraid to die, and that's not your problem. You're afraid to live. So all that dialogue is in the movie, but not at these locations. And then a kid hands to Kurgan a rabbit. Well, you know what he's going to do to that rabbit.
Right.
It's drunk, biting him hard. The rabbit bites Kurgan. And that's it. Flinging it from here, he takes off.
Wow.
So all that zoo stuff, we shot it but I didn't use it.
Can you shed some light on a famous scene that was that a lot of fans have speculated about that was cut? And it was the Kurgan and Youngdahl Kim fight scene where Kim pretty much gives himself up. I've heard some stories about shooting on that. Were you there for that? And do you remember much of that?
No, what scene is that? I mean, I have the script in front of me.
It was
the guy with the machine gun.
No. This was a guy who I think was working as like a I want to say an office building, and the Kurgan tracks him down and ends up fighting him, but then Youngdahl Kim gives himself up and the Kurgan takes his head. And I heard stories of them not putting this in the film, but also the film getting destroyed as well. That's just a rumor, but there's still pictures that have been taken of this that have been put to some motion.
It's not Kirk. It's not Kirk, man. Mantunas.
No, not Kirk Matunas. This is Youngdahl Kim. Yeah.
I don't think he was ever in this script. This script is dated, no, I don't think we ever saw anything like that.
Okay.
It must have been done. They did in UK. But I don't even see it in the script.
Yeah, I think they had like a different version of it as well. Regarding the locations, and Lee, if you have anything you want to ask regarding this, how were some of these locations chosen? And did they have a list, or were you sought after and asked, or how did that
work? The script and what they wanted to shoot in New York. I mean, there were storyboards like for the Silver Cup. They shot anything with water, heavy water was done in the tank in the UK. But her, Brenda hanging off of a pipe with New York skyline behind it, we shot. So anything that showed the city, we shot, but everything had to match. So we had to like build the Silver Cup's letters, gigantic ones that could drop. Mm-hmm. And I think they also built the letters in UK too. They built the whole sign on a stage. So the continuity between what we were doing and what they were doing was very important that everything worked. So the Silver Cup thing, you know, was, and of course the stunt of the car coming up the West Side Highway, threading the needle between those gigantic moving trucks and knocking a motorcycle. I think the Armstrongs like to hit motorcycles because we did that in Ranger also. But we needed a traffic jam, you know, on that West Side Highway. And by the time we were going through the trucks and there was empty, it was empty. So I had sent my PAs up to 23rd Street with a lot of street grease, which is $100 bills. And, they found a truck, said, I want you to run out of gas in the middle of the road. And of course it did. And that kind of created a traffic jam that we needed. But those are the things that you do because you got to do them and they're not necessarily approved.
Lee, did you have any
spark kits on the bridge?
Lee,
you know, there were spark kits on the bridge. So all of that car bouncing off the 59th Street Bridge, those are spark kits.
Wow.
You know. A lot of stunt work.
I was going to.
Vic Magnata did a great job.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask about there's the great transition that they have in there from Connor McCloud kind of looking into camera, and then it transitions to that mural of the Mona Lisa. And I always wondered if that was like you found that or if that was planned, because that was probably one of the most powerful images in the series.
Well, the transitions are great. In all of times, the transitions between New York and Scotland and the different people, I thought they did an excellent job. I'm not sure they knew that when they shot them, but they certainly shot a lot of close-ups and things that could be, that would create those. We did have Christopher Lambert's sword drop into the airbag and puncture it. So his sword.
Now this is true. This is the stunt airbag, yes?
Yeah, well, I'm reading from production reports. Two punctures resulting from swords being dropped and several burn holes resulting from squibs going off were found in the safety airbag used on the set and owned by Jerry Hewitt. So there was a delay where we had to take that out and put another one in. The Luma crane operator reported that the head was dropped with minor damage sustained. You know, every little thing I have notes on. There was a work delay with rain for like 2 hours because the helicopter couldn't fly. And then we couldn't work during rain and lightning. So there was, you know, shooting outdoors at night in New York City is something that you have to be able to adjust to and make it work.
That's great.
Car accident due to the stunt miscue caused damages and resulted in a non-completion of the scene. New York water shortage necessitated out-of-state water trucks.
Wow. Yeah. Huh. You mentioned briefly working with Russell McKahee. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. What was he like to work with on the set, and you know, what did he bring to it?
Well, he brought a lot of night work and a lot of water, and those were the two most difficult things to deal with. But a very, you know, prompt, on time, was, you know, understood the delays that we had, the reasons for them. And I'm not sure whether we went a couple of days over. We would, let's see how many days. Well, you see, Andy Armstrong was the director of the second unit, and that was working in conjunction with the first unit. So there were 7 days of second unit work. And I don't know, I'll see how much first, but we were there from July 8th to July 18th. So we had to do all that in 10 days, really.
Wow.
With two units working. Mm.
That's ambitious.
And that was the same thing with Turtles, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They came, you know, and shot a week, but it was a tough week. I mean, you're on Midtown Manhattan at night with rain again, and you're in the subway system, and you're down in the tracks, and you're in the, you know, all that takes a ton of preparation and permits.
Yeah. Right.
You know, you just don't think, oh, we're going to pop into New York for a week and get our stuff and go home. And Turtles was not the best. They were kind of had a low budget. I mean, it was kind of tough with them. Highlander, there was no problem with the money or with the cooperation of the crew.
You mentioned meeting Christopher Lambert. Could you elaborate on that and you know, either speaking with him or, well, obviously he had a translator.
Well, I did speak with him. I can't speak French.
What was he like?
Well, he was like a guy who just stood around and didn't say anything. You know, and I don't normally work very close with the leading actors. You know, they're doing their thing and in their dressing rooms, and I'm doing everything else. So I don't have that kind of relationship, especially during the shoot.
Right.
Now, you know, like on Sliver, or The Temp, where you're with Sharon Stone for a long time, you get to know you're in the hotels and everything else, that's different. But, you know, it was, I can't say anything negative about him, except that he wasn't the most personable guy because, you know, I didn't speak his language.
What about Clancy Brown?
Clancy was scary. He was Clancy all the time. You almost didn't want to talk to him. Yeah, and he took tons of time to get made up. I was looking here. There was a 4:30 a.m. makeup call for him for a 6 o'clock shoot. 2 hours of makeup time.
Wow.
Been there.
Lee, did you have any other questions regarding Highlander?
I've honestly just been rapt with attention here. This is pretty fascinating listening to him talk. I was just going to see filming those fight scenes. Now, I know a bunch of them were filmed over in Europe, but was the one, the alley fight between Clancy and Christopher,
that
was filmed in New York. Yeah.
Part of it. No, not the whole thing, because they created that street for all the special effects and everything. But we shot the beginning of that scene where you could see the alley and the New York. But I think, again, they created that alley. So they had control over the effects. And, you know, the parking lot scene, that was in UK. If you notice the cars that are in the parking lot, there's a lot of European cars, not a lot of American cars. There are some in the foreground. But then we had to take the signage, which we sent them of what Madison Square Garden parking garage was like. And then, of course, he comes roaring out of it, you know, and it's raining and the New York police, and we do all of that scene. But all of that special effects was in the UK. And the sword play on the roof, on Silver Cup roof, that was basically the only sword play, I think. Where we had a lot of other than.
I wanted to ask you, now, when Highlander was released in the theater, it didn't do well, but it gained a lot of momentum on video. Then a sequel came out, the television series came out, more sequels came out. When did you start to realize that Highlander was resonating with fans more than ever? And do you get a lot of fans still coming up to you and asking you about Highlander?
Well, basically, when I got on Facebook and saw the podcasts that are there and your numbers that you have. But, I mean, I moved on to other movies, and I didn't see any of the other Highlander things. You know, it was kind of, I just moved on. I mean, I did like Highlander, and I liked being Highlander 1, but I didn't follow all the sequences. But now I'm getting calls or requests from at least two or three podcasts, plus Jonathan's book, Melville's book, he got me a year ago, and I did a lot of interviews with him for the book.
Jonathan came on our show a couple times, and we're excited to see about this book that he's writing of the 1986 original Highlander, Jonathan Melville.
Great. Well, he just contacted me this week. He's into the New York segment again and wanted some more information. So I think his book will probably be very, very influential in archiving the history, and very accurate, because he's talking to the people.
Right. Before we let you go, we got a couple more questions here, but I want to ask you about Remo Williams. We were talking before recording. You had the opportunity to take advantage of a very interesting situation for an action scene, right, where at the time, right, the Statue of Liberty was being refurbished with scaffolding, and you got a chance to basically make an incredible action scene out of this.
Well, the script called for a construction crane, you know, big, tall construction crane over Manhattan, showing, you know, and so I checked around, but then I wrote back and I said, you know, guys, I can do a lot better than that. I can get you on the Statue of Liberty all the way up to the flame above it. Wow. Because the U.S. government, Parks, had a law that nobody could touch or be on the Statue of Liberty. But during the restoration, the legal ownership of the statue was transferred to the American French Restoration Corporation. So it was no longer U.S. property. It was mutual. So I went to that group and said, now, there's no law against it. Can we work with you and do it? And they said, yeah, we can do it, but you're going to have to hire our high wire climbers. If you want a camera at a certain place, our guy has to take it up there. And you can't have more than 8 people on the scaffold at any one time. And so we got these incredibly expensive climbers. They're taking these specially designed camera mounts and mounting them at certain places on the scaffold. And then the day of the shoot, we're handing them the cameras and they're going up and placing them. And, you know, it was unbelievable to be up that high. I mean, I was standing above the torch.
Wow.
And then the company needed to slide down the arm and do a whole thing. So they built in Mexico a full-size replica from the bust up of the statue for all of that work.
Wow.
But we did all the high angles and running around the base and all that. And so now, once it reverted back to the U.S. government, nobody will ever be able to film on this statue. We're the only ones ever.
Fascinating.
And I got to say, that is one of my favorite movies from when I was a kid. It's one of my dad's, too. And Kevin, you took the question right out of my mouth. My dad wouldn't have forgiven me if I wouldn't have asked about that scene. because that is just iconic. It's on the cover of the the video box. Everything. So
Lee, did you have any more questions for Edwin Itzy Atkins here?
Well, as a really tall, long-haired stuntman turned actor, I got to ask about your experience working with Steven Seagal on one of his early movies, Out for Justice.
I hated it. I hated working
on it. That's what I hear from a lot of people.
First of all, he was late because every lunch he was at Gotti's house having lunch. And he'd come an hour late, this and that. And Mike and John Flynn, the director, was a good director. But, it, you know, when your main actor shows up whenever he wants, especially after lunch when you weren't trying to fight. And then you have to use SAG extras for actors, you know. And if you don't, you got to say why you can't find, you know, a SAG actor in New York. It's pretty hard to do. But Steven would always want his buddies and all these Italian people. And I'd say, look, we got to do 12 station 12s today. We have to pay a fine, $250 for every one of your buddies. They got to be in the movie because that's what you want. I mean, it was just that kind of thing. You know, he really didn't care. And he didn't do anything to help the production in terms of meeting our schedule. And I don't know. And he was having fights with his cousin, you know, the producer of it. So it wasn't a pleasant experience.
Itzy, I want to say before we let you go, first of all, thank you so much for coming on Blood of Kings. And I did want to give you the opportunity to let people know what you've been working on recently, if there's anything you want to promote or how people can get a hold of you if you want.
Well, I'd like for you to follow me on Facebook, you know, and I am doing some college lectures. I'm probably going to do at the University of Georgia a lecture on Highlander.
Oh,
which
wow.
I might want to use excerpts of your interviews and probably one on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But so I'm doing those, and I'm you know, I'm actually a historian, so I'm doing a lot of history stuff and doing oral history.
I
miss New York. I've been in Georgia for 3 years, and you know, Atlanta is a film city, and there's a lot going on, but it's not like New York.
And, well, I lived in the Atlanta area for quite a while, so I know where you are. First of all, I'm really excited that you worked on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I loved that as a kid. I'm able to share that with my kid. And just a quick question. Did you realize how big this was at the time that you were working on it, how big this franchise was?
No. Well, you know, I mean, the costume, the puppets were done by, you know, the Muppet guy, and that was – but they were shooting in North Carolina to save money. It was a non-union shoot. They wanted to come to New York and shoot non-union, which is unheard of. So anyway, I accommodated them. I actually couldn't be the production manager because I was a member of the Directors Guild. So they hired me as a production supervisor. And, you know, it was that kind of thing all the way down. So it was, and it was a week. And they didn't give us enough prep time to come in. But, you know, I'm glad the movie did good. But you mentioned Avenging Force.
Yes, Michael Dudikoff and Steve Jane's film.
Yeah, that was a fun movie. I'll tell you, shooting in those swamps, we had to build platforms 12 inches under the waterline so the crew could get out and put lighting towers and get out into the swamp.
That doesn't sound like fun.
And alligator hunters to go out there. Nobody would step in that swamp. They'd have to go in and put in the pilings and build all the platforms for everywhere that he was running through the swamps. It was a nightmare.
But you got to work, was it Glickenhaus, the director, right?
Yeah, right. I did 5 movies in New Orleans. I liked it.
Wow.
You know,
and I got to say, I'm a huge fan of Moon Over Parador.
Huh?
Moon Over Parador is one of my favorite movies. Moon Over Parador?
Oh, yeah. No, it was just location work. That wasn't...
Yeah, but beautiful location in that one.
Yeah, getting into the public theater. And, you know, when you're connected to New York and these people come in, it's really, they're hiring you for your connections so that you can get in the public theater or you can get in a subway hole. Because if you're an L.A. production guy who comes in, then that could give you the time of day. In fact, it's illegal and you need to be on the New York list. So, like, for example, I was a approved New York location manager. When Robert Wise took me to L.A., I became a studio on the studio list. So when we did Sliver, they didn't have to hire two production managers. I was in both New York and L.A. because I was flying back and forth every week. But that was a some movie, too. Sliver, where we lost a helicopter in the volcano at the end.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on Blood of Kings. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
This was amazing. Well, when I write my book, I'll get back with you. Maybe you can help me publicize it. But follow me on Facebook for now.
Will
do. And I do have a group called Georgia Film Locations, but it's just a place to talk about Georgia films. And and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Itzy, appreciate it. Until next time. All right, sir.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank Bye-bye. You very much, sir.
Bye-bye. All right. I want to thank Edwin Itzy Atkins, our 1986 Highlander New York production manager, for coming on. I want to, first of all, thank you for coming on, Lee. I know it was troubling for you to make it, but you made it.
You know, once I saw his whole filmography, I had to be here. It's reminded me of the days when I just listened to this podcast because I'm listening and just being fascinated. I get to hear it firsthand. So this was pretty cool listening to those stories.
Well, Jonathan Melville, I got a chance to meet him in person in Edinburgh, Scotland. And of course, we've had him on Blood of Kings twice. He's been working on a book for the 1986 Highlander film. And he's been talking to everyone that he can. And Itzy was one of them. And he says, Kevin, you got to get a hold of this guy. This guy is, he's a legend when it comes to working specifically in New York as well. Were you familiar with a lot of his work prior to us interviewing him?
I wasn't familiar that he was a part of it, but as soon as he told me that we had this, I looked up and it's like I am watching HBO at my dad's house in the 80s and 90s. Because, Avenging Force. I mean, you know I love me some Michael Dudikoff and Steve James, the American Ninja.
That's one of the reasons why you're on Blood of Kings.
Yeah. But Moon Over Parador, which basically I would call that in a Latin American version of Dave, but made about 10 years earlier.
Right.
It was just a really good Richard Dreyfuss movie. I absolutely loved it. Clear and Present Danger. I'm a huge, I read all the Tom Clancy books until the recent, series that aren't written by him. So, and that was, I think the better of the two Harrison Ford, Jack Ryan, movies.
Yeah.
And the assassination scene that he's talking about, if you go back and watch that, movie, you kind of forget just how intense it is. And they reuse it kind of the same premise in the Jack Ryan TV show. And even with kind of a modern budget and all the new tricks that we've learned, they've really, it's a hard one to beat. Just the intensity and the claustrophobic nature of it, but necessary roughness. Oh my God. if I didn't have that one on, just burned out watching that one over and over again. Rooftops again. It was the first time I had seen a martial art called capoeira that I've spent a bit of time studying when I was going to the University of Iowa, and again when I was overseas.
Isn't that the martial arts that Mark DeCosco uses in Only the Strong?
Yes, sir, it is. And this one predates that movie by about a good 5-6 years.
Wow.
Mark DeCosco is a much better martial artist. But the capoeira crew, and I want to say it was Amin Santos, was one of the main stuntmen in that, but he was a couple of the fathers of capoeira being introduced to the United States. And it's become more well-known. And it was just kind of a perfect blend of, you know, the breakdancing move of the 80s, you know, kind of the big kung fu kick that came out of the 70s and into the ninja movies that you and I grew up on. But it was every time I see a movie that has something I've never seen before in terms of a fight, it always sticks with me. And that was, you know, they have improved on it, but that first time that you see something and say, wow, is hard to get over it. And then of course, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I mean, we're of the age when that came out, You know, I think I was 12 when that one hit theaters, 11 or 12. Yeah. And me and my buddy Kurt, we went and saw that probably four or five times because it was at the Dollar Theater down the street.
I love it. It still holds up for me.
Yeah. And I will say my dad was part of the test audience that had the ending changed because he thought that was too violent for kids. So the original audience that has been lost to time, my dad was part of the reason why that happened. I'll let everyone else judge. But I, of course, loved the movie when I was a kid, so I don't feel too bad about it. But I know some people have their opinions. Of course, Highlander. I mean, as visual as that movie is, you know, the production and location work that goes into it is really something spectacular. We've, you know, I shoot around the Midwest, and I'm fortunate in Minneapolis that we have a lot of different neighborhoods that can double as other places. So we pretend that we're in New York all the time here. And of course, we're kind of famous from Purple Rain and all that. But, you know, just as I kind of said when I was able to get in, you cannot underestimate how important production management is and location management.
I'm glad you brought that up with ITZY because it's a lot of behind the scenes hard work. And I really appreciate you mentioning that to him because they are unsung heroes, wouldn't you say?
Oh, very much so. And my comment earlier about not getting credit is when the movies get made, you know, there's the pretty people that were on camera that generally do all the press work and get known for what they did. But they're able, you know, guys like me are able to do what we do because there's somebody that's working a lot before we ever get there. I've been a producer on a couple films, and I had thought that stunt work was exhausting until I did production because you're down to every, all the bullets, all the beans, all the butter, everything that goes into making the production. You've got to have it figured out. When you mess up, you didn't mess up your work. You messed up somebody else's. So anybody that's good, and from his resume, he's very good.
Yeah.
You just deserve all that credit because actors and stuntmen and directors can do what they do because of guys like this. And I just want all of our listeners to know, stay through the credits. Look at everybody that works on those. And it all comes down to production managers. They are the ones that are in charge of getting all that stuff done. You know, directors do the casting and producers, you know, throw money at a script. But, and actors stand around, do pretty, memorize our lines. And I don't want to, you know, downplay our job, but there is so much more work that is done in film that you never even see. And I had a production manager this just before Christmas. Was working a really long day. I was playing an ICE agent, had to be mean all day. And I had a out time that meant I wasn't going to be able to have dinner with the crew. And the production manager, just a wonderful lady named Laura, she mixed me up a plate without me even knowing it, wrapped it in this beautiful old gingham towel that she had, and said, "Why don't you take this and have some, because I know you really like Alfredo sauce." And every time I'm on set with her, it's just one of those things, like she knows the crew, she knows everybody, she takes care of everybody. I was just, you know, kind of a day player in that. I had three lines and I wasn't central to the plot. I was just guiding it, but, she was looking out for me. She was looking out for everybody else on set. And, you know, people like that, you know, and a good one, you know, and what he was saying about, working with, Steven Seagal, when you have people that you can't work with, you know, and he's kind of working from the reverse, but, you know, his job is to make sure that everything goes well.
Yeah. I appreciate his candor on that. You know, it's that, you know, everything wasn't sunshine and roses there. And it's, you know, sometimes you come across a difficult production, whether it has to do with the director or in this case, the lead star.
Yeah. And I love that movie. You know, it's that early Steven Seagal before he became too annoying in public.
I liked it too, actually. I like the villain. William, what's his last name?
William Forsythe.
I love Forsythe. William Forsythe. He was just a great villain in that. I want to ask your opinion on something. We touched on it in an interview with Itzy. Huge fan of Rima William, The Adventure Begins, starring Fred Ward.
Oh yeah.
About a cop who is supposedly killed off, and then he kind of becomes this, he's trained as this kind of like superhero secret agent type of person. And this is a time when the Statue of Liberty was being repaired or refurbished. So it wasn't as pretty to look at because it had all this scaffolding around it. But it really made a fantastic action scene in this film. And I really enjoyed this film. This is one of those films I wish would have garnered a sequel, but never did. What was your take on that?
Oh, man. That was one. I remember my dad rented that movie for me. And this was shortly after my parents got divorced. So I'd go over to dad's and we'd watch movies. And, you know, he introduced me to Big Trouble in Little China. But Rima Williams, I remember that just being one of his favorites. And, you know, we laughed. And that was young Captain Janeway played his love interest in that movie.
Yes, yeah.
There's a few cringy racial stereotypes in there that make it a little harder to watch in modern eye. But back then... You know, I'm talking about the character Chun, in some circles that is regarded as the origin of parkour.
Yes, exactly.
The way that he's running around, the way that he's learning how to navigate the city and do all of his crazy stunt work, that really hadn't been done outside of a circus, and it definitely hadn't been done as part of action sequences. And, you know, then fast forward, about 20 years, and you've got Casino Royale starting with a parkour chase with Daniel Craig basically being a sledgehammer running through a building. But no, I've absolutely loved that movie. And that was the one thing I wanted to make sure I got a little information about, because my dad wouldn't forgive me if I didn't bring it up. And I know he's probably going to be a big fan of the show, mostly because he's very supportive father.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. Well, thank you again for coming on, Lee. I'm glad you made it right at the last minute here. Wanted to let people know, first of all, how they can get a hold of us here on Blood of Kings. Want to thank all the fans and everyone on the Blood of Kings Facebook group supporting the show. And if you'd like to get in touch with us online or through social media, here is how. First of all, you can find Blood of Kings and all of our other great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network on our master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is also on the Podbean app. You can also find the Fandom Podcast Network on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. You can find Blood of Kings on Twitter and Instagram. As I mentioned, if you are not part of the wonderful Facebook group, please search for Blood of Kings, a Highlander fandom group. We've got a lot of great Highlander fans in there. We also have the sister group, Blood of Kings, a Highlander CCG collectible card game and gaming discussion group page. You can also email us at bloodofkingspodcast@gmail.com. My name is Kevin. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. My co-host, Lee, how can we find you on social media?
Look me up on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at The Way of the Way or Madman Road. Just drop me a line. I'm usually pretty chatty.
Awesome. Great. And also, we want to let people know that there is two ways you can support the Fandom Podcast Network. Please, on Apple Podcasts, search Fandom Podcast Network, and please leave us a review. We love 5-star reviews, of course, but we love feedback in general. And if you like what you're hearing on Blood of Kings, search Fandom Podcast Network on Apple Podcasts and let us know there. Also, you can support us by heading to our TeePublic store, help support the Fandom Podcast Network and Blood of Kings, and get your own Blood of Kings t-shirt and other apparel. Please search Blood of Kings or Fandom Podcast Network on TeePublic. Again, I'd like to thank our very special guest, Edwin Itzy Atkins, the New York production manager on the 1986 original Highlander film. Please check out what else he's done. He's an unsung hero among people that work behind the camera and really bring these wonderful locations to you in these awesome films. Lee, thanks again for coming on, my friend.
Hey, I'm glad to be part of the team.
I'm Kevin, and on behalf of my special guest, Edwin Itzy, thanks everyone for listening, and join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network. Lee, that sensation you are feeling is the quickening. We are one. We are brothers. Goodbye, everyone.